We're just about 3 weeks away from the christening of a new year, but before we do, it's time to step back and reflect on some of the bigger news stories of 2018, and what better way to do that than by bringing on a panel of hard-nosed muckrakers from Western Wisconsin and Madison. For the rest of the hour, we'll be speaking with reporters about some of the biggest stories that they covered in 2018 during the West Side News Year in Review. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for joining us today. Now to work my way through the all-star panel. In the studio with us today is Shannon Hoyt. She is WQOW's TV's weekend news anchor. Shannon Hoyt, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you. Joining us by phone from his office in Barron, we've got Bob Zintera. He is the editor of the Barron News Shield. Bob, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Thanks for joining us. And also in studio is Andrew Dowd. He's a reporter for the Eau Claire Leader Telegram, and he's also live tweeting the heck out of all your city council meetings. Andrew Dowd, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks, Rich.
Good morning. Good to have you. And joining us from our studios in Madison, Wisconsin Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief and karaoke soul singer extraordinaire, Sean Johnson. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Good to have you. Listeners, if you've got a list, I don't know if you've made a list of top news stories, but just give us a call and let us know what you thought some of the bigger stories from your region, from the state. It could be national. 1-800-228-5615 is the number to call. Is there anything that you thought got maybe too much coverage or was undercovered in Western Wisconsin? Now's your chance to call and let the reporters have it. So 1-800-228-5615. Sean Johnson, I'd like to start with you, sir, because, I mean, first of all, I tend to kind of go backwards and, you know, you forget about the stuff that happened earlier in the year, but this was a busy year at the state capitol, and it was a busy year for politics in the state and nationally. So what would you say is the top news story that you covered?
Yeah, as often happens in an election year, you sit down to write your year-end story or do these year-end programs, and like all I can remember is what happened in November.
Yeah.
But I would say that this November's elections were, you know, pretty consequential as Wisconsin goes, because we've had Republican leadership in Wisconsin for the last 8 years, pretty much without a break. Governor Scott Walker has made a national name for himself as kind of a conservative superstar. And, you know, his governorship is coming to an end. Tony Evers was able to defeat him in a very close election for governor. And Democrats won in the other statewide offices as well, and for U.S. Senate with Tammy Baldwin. So it's hard not to look back at the election that we just had and say that was probably the biggest thing that happened, you know, politically speaking.
It was, and it's just, well, first of all, how late of a night was that for you? Because the we didn't find out until early in the morning, right?
No, it was such a close race for governor and attorney general. I think it was around 2:30 in the morning or so that we wrapped up our broadcast. Mm-hmm. They had those ballots that had not yet been counted from the city of Milwaukee.
Right.
The absentee ballots. And, you know, once those were counted, City of Milwaukee went strongly to Evers and to Call, and that put them up over the top. But it was especially close and, you know, a high turnout race. And so in a very, very late election night and morning.
Yeah, it was, I mean, high turnout for sure. So I kind of want to go back a little bit. And I've heard some reports and I've seen some headlines that say the Walker era has ended. The Walker era. That's a funny thing to think about, because it just was, you know, normal to have him as governor for so long. As far as from reporting the news, you just see him all the time.
Yeah, it has not been a quiet 8 years for him.
Right.
You know, he served as long as Governor Jim Doyle did, but I'm not sure that people would attach an era to Governor Jim Doyle. I mean, Governor Mm-hmm. Governor Jim Doyle did consequential things as governor, and you know, those were certainly better years for Democrats than the past eight have been. But I think I don't think it's overblown to look at the last 8 years as an era for Walker because of how far he shifted the state to the right, mm-hmm. and, you know, how he kind of empowered the Republican Party in a number of ways, you know, potentially for years to come after he's gone, and all the judges that he appointed, the Supreme Court that is now, at least for the time being, you know, conservative, mm-hmm. Right to Work, Act 10, voter ID,
yeah,
kind of just go on, and he's made this state more Republican.
Absolutely. A reminder to our listeners, we're talking about some of the top news stories of 2018. Right now, we're speaking with Sean Johnson. We've also got, he's the WPR Capital Bureau Chief. In the studio, we've got Shannon Hoyt of WQOW-TV and Andrew Dowd of the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram, also by phone, Bob Zintera, editor of the Barron News Shield. So if you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-228-5615. Also, chime in and let us know what you thought the top news story or news stories were from your perspective, 1-800-228-5615. Say, Bob Zintera, I wanted to go to you now. And as far as the election's concerned, I mean, this is definitely, this was a high turnout race or high turnout election statewide. What did you see up in your area? I don't think there were any big upsets as far as the state assembly or state senate races, but still, anything notable from the Barron County area?
I think in our market, the incumbents, one Democratic state senator, one Republican assembly member, were pretty secure in their campaigns. However, on a statewide basis, the next-door Senate district that was once occupied by a Republican, mm-hmm. excuse me, for the better part of 17 years, now the, I believe she's a Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection Secretary.
That's right.
There was a special election in January to fill her seat, and an incumbent Republican assembly member was defeated by a Democrat from Somerset, Wisconsin, in that election, which I think a lot of folks took as a bellwether for what might happen in the November election. And it turned out that way, at least on a statewide basis.
Yeah, absolutely. Now Secretary Sheila Harsdorf had that state Senate seat, Sean Johnson, for decades, right? Like something like close to 20 years?
17.
17 years. And Patty Shockner is now the incumbent. But she, Bob, she's coming up for election before a full term, right? She's maybe got a year or two, and it'll be any ideas? Have you heard any rumblings from people up there about what might happen when she has to go through the regular cycle?
From what I'm being told, and this is a neighboring district, so I'm not too privy to,
right.
to the information, I would say that the district that Sheila Harsdorf occupied is pretty solidly Republican, particularly as pertains to St. Croix County,
right.
which is the most populous of the counties in her district. I think that Shockner will have a battle on her hands when she stands for re-election.
Sure, and Sean Johnson, I remember kind of how you worked with me on that election night. That was, I think, in January or maybe early February. And tell me about Sean Johnson. Tell me about the swing that we saw from the 2016 presidential to that turnout in that special.
If I remember right, it was something like a 20-point swing.
Yes,
toward Democrats. And kind of an overwhelming victory for Patty Shockner from a percentage standpoint. You know, there was no doubt she won that election in a seat that everybody kind of assumed was Republican, especially because of St. Croix County has been this growing Republican stronghold in a way in Wisconsin. And so that really, I mean, that got people's attention, especially because Donald Trump has struggled. The Republican Party has struggled in suburban areas mm-hmm. in the Trump era. And here was another example of that in St. Croix County. So the trick for Patty Shockner, as you know, was just alluded to, is a general election is going to see different turnout. The people that turned out in that, you know, winter election here was low turnout election. They were you know, passionate Democrats who went out and and supported Patty Shockner. As you saw in one of the other races this year, where a Democrat won the special election, Caleb Frostman, in the first Senate district over in, you know, Door County, he was able to win that race, a similar swing, like a 20-point swing toward Democrats in the special election. But when it came time to the general election, it was still a Republican seat, and Republicans were able to get it back in that setting.
I want to talk about, I could talk about politics all hour, but the with the lame duck, there was a Caleb Frostman curveball, wasn't there? As far as, you know, the fact that the election wasn't going to be held, but then it was held, and it turned out to be kind of consequential in a way. Isn't that right, Sean?
Yeah, it did. I mean, remember the thing that we were told about that special election from Governor Walker was that it would be a waste of money, and the legislature wasn't going to come back at all this year. So there's really no point in filling that seat. Well, they did, and they came back for some pretty big stuff in this session that just wrapped up for these bills that Governor Walker just signed on Friday. And so Republicans were still able to do most of what they wanted to do, but Frostman being there instead of a Republican being there, and, or instead of just an empty seat, meant that it was harder for Republicans to get those votes. And some of the stuff that they talked about doing, some of the stuff that they proposed, you know, moving the date of another election, a Supreme Court, the presidential primary in 2020, they were not able to get that done. You know, it's just in the Senate, they still have a kind of a slim vote margin there. And, you know, Frostman being there was probably consequential in some way.
1-800-228-5615. We had a caller that wasn't able to stay on the line, but they had a question. They wanted to make a comment about gerrymandering or the redistricting. Basically, the caller was saying that it wasn't a real election because of gerrymandering. So, Sean Johnson, I'll go to you on this again. We saw a U.S. Supreme Court case get sent back to the lower courts on whether or not Wisconsin's maps are unconstitutional or not. So, you know, to what effect could you, you know, tell us that redistricting or gerrymandering, however you want to label it, you know, what kind of an impact did that have on the incumbents that largely held their seats in the legislature?
That case, by the way, is still alive because the U.S. Supreme Court sent it back. I think you could say on a technicality, they said that the case didn't have standing and the justices did not dismiss it. I mean, they sent it back. So the case is still alive, and that case is going to go to trial again in its new form this coming April. So, you know, stay tuned. That's an issue that the Supreme Court may yet weigh in on, albeit with another Trump nominee on the bench now. You know, as far as the maps, I think you're going to hear this refrain for the next 2 years from Democrats that, you know, look, we had a 50-50 election. And in fact, in state assembly races, our candidates received about 54% of the vote. And, you know, we only got about 36% of the seats. So there's something wrong with the maps. What you're going to hear from Republicans is that, yeah, well, that's because all your votes are packed into Dane County and Milwaukee County. And they're actually calling into question, in sometimes not so subtle ways, the legitimacy of Governor Evers, saying he's the governor of, you know, Dane County and Milwaukee County, basically. Sure. That's going to be, I wouldn't call it a dialogue necessarily, but that's going to be sort of like the mudslinging back and forth for the next 2 years between the two parties.
All right. And we've got a break coming up, and I know that Sean isn't able to stay with us for the full hour, but there's been a lot of news about this lame duck legislation, and the bills were, I mean, they had a lot of stuff in there, and I think we're still trying to figure out as reporters some of what was in there and how it all plays out. The governor surprised some people. He said he hinted at possible vetoes, and then he did not. And then there was a Venn diagram, and I mean, it's just so. Can you try to give us a quick snapshot of what this lame duck session stuff was all about? You know, in plain English, if possible, sir.
In some ways it locks into place policies that Walker was able to get through over the past 8 years, especially when it comes to stuff that Walker did with the Medicaid program or with food share, requiring work for a single adults to receive food share, for example.
Right.
That's done through a waiver through the federal government. And when you talk about a waiver, it's basically just the state asking for permission to do things a little bit differently. As it stood before those bills were signed into law on Friday, Tony Evers could have come in and rescinded some of those waivers on his own. Said basically, no, we're not going to do this. We're going to run the Medicaid program as is. And what they did prevents him from doing that. You've heard Republicans downplay these changes quite a bit, but you saw an example of one of the changes come up last week. Governor Walker was able to cut a deal with Kimberly-Clark, a $28 million incentive package, and that deal was cut between Governor Walker, Kimberly-Clark, and the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. The legislature need not be involved because the legislature, remember, was unable to pass the Kimberly-Clark bill throughout all of 2018.
Right.
If it had been under the law that the governor then signed the next day, he wouldn't have that power. He'd have to go to the legislature. And so who knows if it would be done. And so Tony Evers in that way and kind of, you know, many others will have less power than Governor Walker did. Now, he'll still have a very strong veto power. He'll still propose a budget. He'll control appointments. The Wisconsin governor's office is still strong, but it's not as strong as the one that Governor Walker enjoyed for the past 8 years.
Right. And so finally, you know, we've kind of skimmed over 2018 in terms of state politics. Do you have any predictions for 2019? I mean, what kind of things are you going to be watching, Sean, either through the rest of these weeks of 2018 or early next year?
The thing that I'm watching for now, I guess a couple of things. I'm watching for what happens with one of the lame duck bills that passed, which would restrict early voting in Wisconsin.
Yeah, going to court.
Those restrictions are very similar to restrictions that a federal judge struck down in 2016. So we'll be watching to see what happens there, when they end up in court, and what happens there. And as far as, I guess another thing I'm watching for is what happens with Governor Walker next. You know, it's sort of rare for somebody who's been on the political stage in the way that he has and really been involved with politics his whole working life to just fade off into the sunset. So What's he going to do? And then I guess next year, I'm just focused on the budget. You're going to have a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature, and feels like it could be it feels like they won't see eye to eye on a whole lot and that it could go kind of late.
Yes. Yeah. I remember years before Governor Walker was elected, the budget would go into the fall So I would suspect that could happen too.
Sometimes. I mean, when it was Governor Doyle, a Democrat, and a Republican legislature, he'd propose stuff that he knew they weren't going to support. They would pass stuff that they knew he was going to veto. And so I think there will be a lot of that. Maybe they'll figure out how that kind of new working order, you know, suits them in 2019. But you also have the possibility that they're going to dig in and it's going to be, you know, a rough year in state politics.
Or everyone could, you know, put their differences aside and work together for the common good.
Yeah, sure. That's what's happened since Election Day, right?
Yes.
A lot of that.
Yeah, definitely. Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief. Sean, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your insight, and thanks for being on the program.
Thanks, Rich. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And we're continuing to our discussion about the top local, regional, state, and national news stories of 2018 with reporters from Western Wisconsin. We just bid adieu to Sean Johnson of our WPR studios in Madison. So, listeners, what stories do you think should top the list for 2018 news stories? What do you think was maybe undercovered, or did something get too much coverage? We've got a lot of time left, and we're going to just dive into a whole number of different topics here. So stay tuned. I'm still going to be joined by Andrew Dowd of the Eau Claire Leader Telegram, Shannon Hoyt of WQOW-TV, and Bob Zintera of the Barron News Shield. This is The West Side.
Support for WPR comes from Al Johnson's Swedish Restaurant and Boutique in Sister Bay, home of Swedish pancakes with lingonberries, open daily from 7 to 3, a Door County tradition since 1949. AlJohnson's.com.
Inclusive Ministry Church is a coalition of several faith communities working to provide a monthly message and a meal for people with cognitive and other disabilities. It's on the third Sunday of each month, 3 p.m. at Lake Street Methodist Church in Eau Claire.
You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning. In the studio with me and on the phone are reporters from Western Wisconsin this hour, and we're talking about some of the biggest local, state, and national news stories of 2018. If you'd like to join us, give us a call at 1-800-228-5615. And before we jump off the politics beat here, I wanted to go to Andrew Dowd because locally in the city of Eau Claire, there was quite a shakeup on the city council. So I'm not sure if that qualifies as one of the top stories, but still, it's consequential for the city. We're seeing a lot of interesting things. So kind of walk us through what happened. This was in April, right?
Yeah, this was back in April. And of course, this isn't probably something that the whole statewide audience is interested in, but in Eau Claire, it's pretty important to folks. On the Eau Claire City Council, there was a large shift where four incumbents, some of them, well, one of them, Bob Von Hayden, served for 15 years, lost their seats to newcomers. And, you know, even though the Eau Claire City Council, like local governments, is a nonpartisan position, there's places you could put people on the political spectrum. And essentially, the city council lost a group of people who were moderate to somewhat conservative and replaced by people who were significantly more liberal and even, you know, very far left liberal.
Yes. And as a result, we just recently saw some things that made statewide news as far as, you know, marijuana fines. There was a I saw you at the meeting where there was a big fight about chickens and all kinds of stuff. So.
And the interesting part about some of these policies were these were brought up, the chicken part that was brought up in the past, chicken keeping.
Yep.
And that had failed on, I believe, three occasions when it had come up in one form or another. Under, again, a slightly more moderate to conservative council where there were concerns about how would neighbors have issue with people raising chickens in their backyard. And then after this sort of like, you know, and it did pick up after the November election, even the liberal folks on council were emboldened by those results, even though those are statewide positions. So they brought back just a few weeks later, they brought back some of these old policies that didn't get passed before, and they sailed through fairly easily. And there was the chicken keep in people's backyard. That's allowed now. In Eau Claire County, there was a referendum held on marijuana, whether people believe that it's something we could allow for medicinal use, recreational use, or still to keep illegal. And the majority of people said medicinal or recreational.
Yeah.
And then so just a couple weeks after that, the city council voted to reduce their local fine for low amount first possession down to $1 plus court costs.
Yeah.
And there was another policy, too, about having children or other family members sit at meetings with council members. And this was raised when one of the council women had a child and wanted to be able to breastfeed while still taking part in meetings. And under the previous city council president, Carrie Kincaid, under her leadership, the city council opted against changing its policy to allow that. But that was brought back in, and that also sailed through. And kind of as a consequence back to that April election when four incumbents were replaced by four newcomers. Just a couple months after that, Council President Carrie Kincaid, who'd served for quite a while in that position, opted to resign and step down.
Yeah.
And since then, we haven't filled her position officially. So in the meantime, Andrew Werthmann has been acting Council President. He's one of the longest serving members, though, too. He's been on for about 10 years.
And it'll be interesting to see the battle, because I just saw some stories about someone maybe challenging Andrew for that. We can talk about that later. Let's cleanse our palate of politics, if possible. But Shannon Hoyt, I wanted to go to you. Just in general, as far as the news stories that you've covered, which would you say, from a regional or a local perspective, kind of topped the list?
Well, I think with our station, we've heavily covered the Jamie Kloss case, but we've also continued to cover the Girl Scouts who were killed in Chippewa yes. County as well. Those two unfortunate tragedies have been really highlighted here in the Chippewa Valley. And it's very surprising. We were talking with our team saying, you know, it seems like it's one after another. We're having these huge stories going national.
Yes.
And Jamie Kloss, of course, she was probably the top one. We've continued to cover that. We were just there the other day in Barron for the Tree of Hope lighting mm-hmm. ceremony for Jamie.
This past weekend, right?
Yes. And to give a little background on October 15th, I know Bob can probably speak to this as well,
yeah,
but
definitely.
On October 15th of this year, Jamie disappeared after her parents were found shot and killed in their home in Barron. And the law enforcement, they don't know what the MO was, if it was targeted event, if it was random. But it's just unfortunate what happened. And this is one of those cases where there's still more questions than answers. People in Barron are still banding together to bring hope into the community. But, I was there pretty much since day one until now. It's been about 2 months,
yeah.
2 months from Saturday, actually. And, being in Barron and seeing Sheriff Chris Fitzgerald, Barron County Sheriff, when I first saw him, first interviewed him until now, actually at this Tree of Hope ceremony, one thing I just remember him saying was, I haven't smiled like this in so long, because he saw just how beautiful it was that the community came together.
Nice.
They lit this tree, they lit lanterns. And, it's been a challenge for the Barron community, but it's definitely not dark there. They're really pulling together to continue to bring hope into this case and to continue to keep it alive, too. A lot of these cases, people forget, and you want to keep it alive.
Yeah, yeah. And Bob Zintera, let's go to you. This is definitely hit home for your area. It drew national attention, but as Shannon Hoyt mentioned, the fact that there's unknowns seems to really really be hitting people hard. So tell us about, what have you been hearing from your local residents or local leaders up there about this whole thing? Do people feel less safe, or how are they healing?
I think when you have a county with a population of 46,000 people, a tragedy like this strikes home in ways that it really doesn't in larger areas, larger, more populous areas. Certainly there are tragedies that take place in large metropolitan areas like this, but it doesn't resonate or radiate or whatever kind of verb you care to use like it does in a community where, to use an overworked term, literally everybody, practically everybody knows everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So from that standpoint, it's been a part of people's lives and thoughts, frustrations, hopes, and sadness for over 2 months.
Yeah.
I'm a relative newcomer to Barron. We moved back here 6 years ago, but around the time that my wife and I got married, I was assistant editor at a weekly paper in Ladysmith. And Jim Kloss, who was one of the two who were killed, his wife Denise, the other, Jim Kloss was an outstanding boys basketball player in Ladysmith at the time. So mm. I remember Jim from 35 years ago and more.
Oh, wow.
And if someone with my connections to the community, which are tenuous compared to a lot of the folks who've lived here for generations, if I'm having those feelings, I can only imagine what it's like for the rest of the folks around here. And the not knowing has been the real compelling factor in all of this. I think that's probably the motivating factor behind the Tree of Hope ceremony, which took place last Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
It was a chance to re-cement the connections between the community and the Kloss family, and particularly the school district where Jamie attended. I'll be going to a school board meeting tonight here in Barron, where one of the donations they're going to be accepting comes from the school district in Luck, Wisconsin.
Oh, wow.
And the teachers, counselors, administrators dug into their pockets and sent the Barron Area School District Counseling Department a donation of $650. out of their own pockets, just as a way of saying, look, folks, we know as school professionals what you're going through trying to deal with your students in the aftermath of this occurrence, and please spend it in whatever way you think is going to help the kids. So emotionally, I think, is the biggest impact. As far as the crimes itself and the investigation, we're pretty much as much in the dark as most journalists, I think, probably would confess that they are. There's so much we don't know and so little to go on in terms of hard evidence that it's a question mark that's going to last through the end of the year.
Yeah, and with, you know, the murdered parents, you know, they were so well known at the Genio Turkey Store. I'm not sure. Did they both work there, Bob?
Yes.
They did.
For more than 20 years, is my understanding.
Yeah, and just the fact that there hasn't been any MO or suspects. I mean, we saw a couple of vehicles, of possible vehicles of interest, but nothing since, right?
Correct. And what the connection is between those vehicles of interest and any suspects which the police have or believe that they have has never really been talked about since then. My latest understanding was that the FBI, the Department of Criminal Investigation, and the Barron County Sheriff's Department are in the process of examining a host of still slides of security video taken that night that they've tried to assemble into a single package. I also watched something that was on television last week where approximately 100 DNA samples, is my understanding, that had been analyzed by the state crime lab were about to be turned over to the investigators, so that they could take a look at it. Sheriff Fitzgerald tells me that it really isn't going to, he doesn't think it's going to have any impact on the investigation immediately, but when the crime is solved, and he's emphasizing when, it's going to help them sort through what happened.
Closure would be nice for the community up there, and it has been emotional. And I went to the first meeting, gathering of hope, that was just after the news kind of broke, and you know, it's been a very emotional thing. And you know, maybe it'd be a good time right now to kind of let people into how, you know, how we approach things. So, Bob, I mean, having to talk to people and interview people about something so tragic, I mean, how do you do that? How does a person do that?
I think the first motivation has to be compassion, the second, respect, and the third, journalism. Unfortunately, that's the order things that need to go in, particularly in a small market. I'm in the weekly newspaper business now. I haven't always been, but I'm most familiar with that aspect of it. And weekly news operations, for better or worse, are considered to be, in some ways, the personal property of the communities that the readers live in.
Yeah.
And they're watching the behavior of news gatherers as they proceed through this thing. So, it's not, I guess the behavior pattern can't be the same as in larger markets and with journalists who are serving more diverse readerships and viewerships.
Well, that said, I was also kind of wondering how local residents might have felt about the national media presence, because I remember back when there was the Chetek tornado, it's a different approach, more aggressive the reporters are, and that compassion, while it's still there, might be further down the list that you gave. So did you hear any complaints or critiques of that?
I would say unofficially and off the cuff, coffee talk at the restaurant, beer talk at the local bar, there's probably some resentment. But I think the longer that this thing has gone on, I think people have come to understand that when a national story like this breaks, this kind of atmosphere is to be expected. I think Chris Fitzgerald has talked on a couple of occasions about how it was this kind of treatment, if you want to use that term by the media was something he had not experienced before. So mm-hmm. for him, just like the rest of us, it was an experience that they needed to go through, sort through, analyze, and kind of interpret as time went on. So I think the resentment's gone down since then, but it was around.
So there has been a lot of tragedy, and we're going to talk about other tragic. I mean, the Girl Scouts and the murder of at the daycare, or the death at the daycare was. It's very heavy stuff. So I want to kind of sprinkle in some less heavy stuff, if possible. What's a less heavy news story out of Barron County right now?
We've had a bipolar year since October. So today in Barron is Chris Cruzy Day. Just about everybody is walking around town wearing a plaid shirt and a backward baseball cap. Chris is going to be on the first of two programs this evening on The Voice, the NBC network show. He's one of four finalists. He's a fellow who's been around Barron his entire life. I've watched him in this 6.5 years that I've been back here, play live performances where his audience has maybe numbered as few as a dozen people.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also had a lot of really solid professional experience. He recorded a hit song called Four Letter Words at a studio in Nashville owned by Dierks Bentley a few years back.
Oh.
So he had some professional credentials going into the Voice competition, and it stood him in good stead. And so people are really excited about that, and viewing parties have been organized today in a number of locations. So we'll be prowling around there watching people's reaction tonight and tomorrow night.
You know, and I saw the funniest thing. Chris Cruzy actually on Facebook made a post that I don't follow him on Facebook, but it was shared, and I got a hold of it. But there was something in the local paper. It was probably the News Shield about someone who was pulled over for speeding because they were late to see the show.
That's correct. Yeah, I think it happened in a neighboring community. I'm not sure if it was Cumberland or something.
It was
like
Cumberland.
That.
That's right.
They were kind of busy trying to hustle home to watch it, and I don't know if they got off with a warning or not.
Yeah,
it was kind of a cool occurrence.
That was fun, and it, the excitement about Chris Cruzy is not limited, Shannon Hoyt, to Barron by any means. I mean, I see signs in Eau Claire and elsewhere when I've been driving around that we support Chris Cruzy. It's like an election. I mean, it is an election of sorts. So, have you seen any excitement here? In the city.
I mean, everybody wants to cheer on a Wisconsinite who is becoming famous. I mean, top mm-hmm. four, that's insane. I mean, I just did a story on this yesterday. A press release was sent out saying, you know, he's the first Wisconsinite to advance to the finale of The Voice. And it's amazing to have our own little local celebrity in
That's
a way.
Right.
And it really, I kind of brought this up with my team wondering how much that impacts the community and impacts local communities, because we did have Cruzy on our show. Oh gosh, I don't know if it was just a couple months ago. It was in the beginning of his start on The Voice.
Oh.
And it's really fun. It brings light to the community. It's a success story we get to see and we get to have a part in. I mean, we get to vote and we can support our community in those kinds of ways.
Someone in our office has already voted all 10 times for Mr. Cruzy. So best of luck to him, and that's an exciting thing to watch. We've got to take our final break here on the West Side. We're talking about the top news stories of 2018 with reporters from Western Wisconsin. We'll round out the discussion and the hour when we return with more from Shannon Hoyt, Bob Zintera, and Drew Dowd, and yours truly, Rich Kramer. This is the West Side.
WPR has been a radio pioneer for more than 100 years. Today, listener support is the largest source of funding. As a donor, you can be proud of the history you've created. Thanks to you, WPR's future includes more in-depth news, world-class music, and great discussions. Continue the spirit of innovation. Make your year-end gift now at WPR.org, and thank you.
You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning. Joining me for the rest of the hour, we've got reporters from local and regional news sources. We're talking about the 2018 News Year in Review here on the West Side. I'm joined by Bob Zantara. He's the editor of the Barron News Shield. Shannon Hoyt is the WQOW's TV's weekend anchor. And Andrew Dowd is a reporter for the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram. 1-800-228-5615 is the number to call if you've got questions or comments. Lord knows there could be news stories that break that might top the list, but let us know what you think. Some of the bigger news stories from your community, your state, or your country are 1-800-228-5615. I hate to go back to tragedy, but Shannon, you mentioned earlier the we've got two stories that also made national news, the death of these Girl Scouts and also this tragic situation at the daycare center. And I covered the first funeral for it was a mother and daughter that were killed. And the story in a nutshell is that someone drove off the road and ran into girls that were picking up trash. Is that correct?
Yes. 21-year-old Colton True, he was driving his truck, and he faces charges of actually intoxicated driving. What we hear is that he and his friend were huffing chemicals, and they were driving down this county road. It's actually a highway that the Girl Scouts, that troop 3055, adopted. And so they were actually picking up trash along the highway when this truck veered off and crashed into five of the 15 people out there. And unfortunately, three Girl Scouts were killed. One was in critical condition, but is home now, actually. And one mother was killed as well.
She's home now, but no doubt her life has changed forever by this tragedy. And when I went to the first funeral for of the group, I didn't even realize what road it was on, and I drove over that bridge, and I went, I saw the sign, and that really, you know, weighed heavy on me as I went to that funeral. And of course, again, as we talked with Bob earlier, you're at a funeral, and you're trying to interview people. It's a tough thing for anyone to have to do. The other story, and Andrew Dowd, I'm not sure if you've done any coverage of this, but the daycare center situation, can you tell us about what that is? That's something that I haven't done any direct reporting on, but I definitely saw national coverage of this. It was just another sad situation.
Yeah, and the story is that a 10-year-old girl in Chippewa County was accused of stomping on a six-month-old baby boy, which killed him, and that happened in late October at a daycare. That story came out on the same day that the 21-year-old man was charged with killing the Girl Scouts. And this 10-year-old girl, she was also in court that day, and it's a very strange situation when the identity of her would be available, and our newspaper and other news outlets are not naming her because it's believed this will end up in juvenile court, where the names are kept private for you know, many different reasons. But I remember being in the office that day, and we saw up on our schedule these two stories, one of a man charged with vehicular homicide for multiple Girl Scouts, and then this child killing another child. And my boss said, you know, does anybody have any fun feature stories or anything? Because we don't want, you know, people to open up the paper and be supremely depressed when they read every single little thing. So, and that case with the 10-year-old girl, that's still going on right now in open court. And I think the latest is they're seeking a competency hearing for her.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Am I incorrect? And I thought I read something about this 10-year-old being perhaps charged as an adult. Or am I off on that? Am I thinking of something else?
Well, right now, yeah, it's going through adult court.
It is.
But it's believed it's going to get kicked back to juvenile court.
I see. 1-800-228-5615 is the number to call if you've got questions or comments, or if you want to share what you think the top news stories of 2018 are. I am joined by Andrew Dowd, Bob Zintera, and Shannon Hoyt. We heard earlier from Sean Johnson of Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. 1-800-228-5615 if you've got any last-minute thoughts on the news year that was and is 2018. We haven't even gotten to national stuff yet. And Lord knows there's a lot. Bob, I wanted to go back to you, Bob Zintera. One of the things that, again, it's funny how everything bleeds together once you get, you know, a month out. The reorganization of the UW system, that happened this year, remember? And so there was some, as far as, there was some big changes for UW-Barron County. Have you been covering any of that? Have you been kind of following up on that?
Much of the attendance and professional base for UW-Eau Claire-Barron County is in the neighboring market of Rice Lake. We
right.
do have some readers in our area who would attend school there. What I would say is that the reorganization that you saw at Rice Lake is the latest in a long list of profound changes that have taken place on the campus over the past several years, including
oh, yeah.
a major downsizing in administration, a reshuffling of how the school is handled and administered. There was some brief, at least on the level of the Barron County Board of Supervisors, debate on the labeling of the campus and how that would play with the public up here. There was an advocate from the Chautauqua area who was making the point that with an annual tuition of in the neighborhood of $7,000 a year, it was possible for an economically challenged Barron County resident to get an education at a price that was easily lower than any other place in the country, and that he claimed contributed to the uniqueness of the campus, and he wanted to preserve that uniqueness as much as possible. So I think people are kind of sitting back and watching what's going to happen next to see how the blending of the two campuses takes place and whether or not it's still possible to get an education here and maybe be able to use the credits that you earn to go to schools other than Eau Claire, which
right.
I think is really a major theme that they're emphasizing.
Right, yeah. And I know that also in the earlier stages when the news first broke, and you know, I worked on a story about who knew what, you know, prior to the announcement that the UW system would be restructured for the first time in like 40 years. And Chancellor Jim Schmidt of UW-Eau Claire was very optimistic about it. And the idea is that this could possibly create more opportunities, whether or not we're going to see that, whether or not the budgetary realities will allow that to happen. Who knows? Because from what I understand, attendance is still not doing great at these some of these what are now branch campuses. So it will be interesting to watch. I wanted to talk, we've only got a few minutes left, so I wanted to talk about fake news with the folks on the show right now. And Shannon, I'll start with you, Shannon Hoyt of WQOW. I've seen a lot of panels where journalists talk about the term fake news. I mean, it's not a new thing, but we saw the president of the United States continue to bash the media for stories that he says are false. A lot of people are kind of pointing out that these stories that he's bashing tend to be critical of him. But do you, from a local perspective, I mean, reporters take heat for the stories that they do. That's nothing new. And I'm sure you've gotten emails and whatnot. But have you seen any change since the president started talking about fake news and don't trust the media? The media is the enemy of the people. Have you seen any of that trickle down to the local level?
I mean, I think, of course, you know, all news is going to be impacted by that, no matter where you are. And even when I was in college, this was a topic that
yes.
we discussed in my journalism program every day was, you know, fake news, how to build credibility with your audience, how to build trust. And you don't want I guess you don't favor someone as high up as President Trump saying something that could be more trustworthy than your local news reporter.
Yeah.
And I do kind of have this fear. Am I connecting with you well enough? Do you trust the work that I give? Is one mistake going to make you not trust me for the rest of the time that I'm working for this area? And it, you know, reporters make mistakes. That's inevitable. You're dealing with so much information that you need to give to thousands of people. And quickly, too. I mean, everything is timely, and people do expect things to be out as soon as possible. So when you're working under that much pressure and you do make a mistake, then, you know, that does hurt your credibility, no matter, you know, if it was a simple mistake or not. And because, you know, they're expecting news, nonetheless, accurate news,
yeah,
and credible news. So it is kind of a fear of a reporter is to make a mistake or to make have people think of you as fake news, because then you feel like, am I doing the job I'm supposed to be doing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of self-reflection in this situation whenever you think that you might have gotten something wrong or whether you did make a mistake. Andrew Dowd, have you been accused of fake news this year?
I can't remember an incident. You can get guff from people every now and then, you know, people bringing up fake news and throwing that term out there. But I think, you know, I focus almost entirely on local politics, and the people I deal with, they know me, they know my reputation.
Yeah.
And the people who understand the difference between local news, what you see on your local TV station at 6, what you read in your local paper and hear on the radio, versus what you're going to see on cable TV news and from a lot of highly opinionated shows, they don't generally throw that around there.
Bob Zantara, I'll give you the last word. Local people do trust their local media, and you mentioned that they even see local papers like the Barron News Shield as kind of a public property. So does that exempt you from, or does that give you some of a buffer from these accusations of fake news?
In a way, but Shannon's right. Accuracy is the credibility or your currency that you carry at work and into your work as a professional. It's and being wrong kind of deducts from that, from the amount of currency that you have in your pocket. So you really have to keep on your toes with that. Luckily, in the market that we have, we're telling people how much their lunch fee is going to be for their kid next fall or what their property taxes are going to be. So it's a little difficult to go into the realm of what you would think is fake news.
With that, thank you. That's our time. I'd like to thank my guests. Bob Zantara is the editor of the Barron News Shield. Thank you so much. Shannon Hoyt is WQOW-TV's weekend news anchor. Thank you, Shannon. Andrew Dowd is a reporter for the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram, specializing in local politics. Thank you, Andrew. And, of course, thanks to Sean Johnson of Wisconsin Public Radio. Have a safe and productive holiday. Have a great holiday season, first of all. And we'll be off. The West Side will be taking a break for the next 2 Mondays. We will be back January 7th. So until then, do have a safe and happy holidays. We'll chat again soon.